Welcome to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. Ken and Melanie Light spent 5 years documenting the Central Valley through photographs and essays for their new book and museum exhibit, Valley of Shadows and Dreams. The exhibit was recently up at the Oakland Museum of California, and it's now moving to Fresno. The Lights met people struggling with teen pregnancy, health problems from environmental pollution, water scarcity, and an ever-widening wage gap. They write that the goal of this book is to use the region to illustrate how we as citizens have allowed our democracy to become skewed. So what do the problems of the Central Valley reveal about the underbelly of both our food system and our democracy? In the Valley, half of the residents have annual incomes below $17,000. Welcome, Ken and Melanie.
Thank you for having us.
So you write, when we began our exploration of California's Great Central Valley, it was surely not our intention to depict the agricultural industry as an exploitive abuser of unregulated capitalism. So let's start there. What was your original intent and how did that change? We'll start with a little softball for you.
Well, originally this project began when I was doing research for another project, and which involved doing research in the Visalia Library, and I had to go through some birth and death records there, and just having contact with the loopy handwriting sort of put me in touch with the fact that there are actual people living here where I, like most Californians, just put the pedal to the metal and try to race through the valley. It was really because of that was the first time I actually stopped and had a look. And when I got out of my car and looked around, what I saw is that there were giant developments being plunked down right in the middle of what I considered the most fertile farmland in America.
And you started in what, 2005?
2006.
Okay, so this is before the economic
before the downturn.
Crash.
Before
it was still cresting.
Crisis.
It was still going crazy, and I was looking at houses for, $350,000. I would, then I on my way back, I took a very leisurely drive from Visalia back to the Bay Area, and I kept stopping at these developments. Like they just had this pull on me, like, crazy, and I was touring through houses that were $350,000, and I kept asking, "Who's buying these houses?" And the PR salespeople would look at me and just kind of go, retirees? And it was so bizarre. And I kept thinking, how can this be? Isn't there some kind of policy that you have to protect farmland? And so that was the beginning. It was really the housing question. And I guess
land use.
That got
you intrigued by this area.
Yeah. And from there, it just went in every direction.
And that's what got her intrigued. But really, our first, I think, journey into the valley was the big immigration demonstrations nationwide. And we went down to Fresno, which at that moment had, I think, the largest demonstration in the history of the city. And
these were the May Day demonstrations?
These were the May Day demonstrations in 2006. And then to see, tens of thousands of undocumented people who all lived in the valley all of a sudden come out of the shadows and be downtown Fresno. It was both liberating and incredibly, incredibly festive. I mean, you not only saw adults, but whole families, grandmothers, people who had lived there for generations, and newly arrived undocumented workers who had worked in the fields, just there demanding their rights. And that was just powerful, incredibly powerful.
So you're documenting all of this throughout the economic crash. It sounds like there was this sort of hopefulness in 2006. How did you see the area change and people adapt to that?
When we first went, I remember one of the developments that we stopped at to talk to the people. What had happened is that farm workers had moved up into construction where they could get much better wage and have a much better quality of life. And they themselves were buying houses. Although, of course, at the time, no one realized that they were being, exploited, and they were one of the prime markets and so on and so forth.
But for subprime lending, you mean?
Subprime lending, yes. Thank you, Holly. Yeah. So it was exciting to think that there is this massive moving up of people.
And then, of course, the crash came, and at the same time the crash came, the drought came. So it was a double whammy for the valley, and it was kind of incredible to just see literally everything stop. I mean, it's hard to even describe where you're driving and you're seeing all types of workers out pouring concrete and framing out houses and sheetrock, and it's, multiple houses and huge developments in which they've paved all the streets, and then, all of a sudden,
It's a ghost town.
It's a ghost town. And you have these, you know, acres and acres of fenced in areas with fancy, with, you know, new trees planted and paved streets and lights and...
And nobody there.
And nobody there. And lots. And just lots with wires, gas wires just coiled up sitting there.
And sagebrush rolling around, tumbleweeds just getting caught. I mean, it was unbelievable, the change overnight.
And another thing that you write about the valley is you say that it's hard to imagine the poverty in the valley that is now known as worse than in the Appalachians. What do you think that we don't know, those of us living in the coastal areas, about the poverty in the Central Valley?
Well, we don't. I don't think we see it, period. I think we just assume that, you know, the fruits and vegetables come into the Bay Area. We're happy to have them. We talk about sustainability. We're, you know, there are some organic farms in the valley, not a lot. It's largely corporate farming. I just don't think we have any sense in California of the people who do all this work.
I mean, so maybe you can help give us a sense. And obviously your book does that. These are some really beautiful photos that show a lot of, you know, everyday life as well as some of the dire poverty.
Sure. Well, I just wanted to add to that, like, you know, we consider ourselves fairly well-traveled and fairly open-minded and progressive. But even for us, I think there's a particular lack of awareness between Central California and coastal Californians. It's deep, it's cultural, it's historic. It's worse almost than the northern and southern divide in many ways. So we, you know, perhaps feel like we have more important things to consider than the scrappy valley. But I remember one time when I was there, we went to, we were in a vineyard and they were picking, these are grapes for, they were small champagne grapes. And it was so hot. I mean, I couldn't stand, I was just standing there for an hour. And after that, I was completely exhausted. So I don't know how these people can work for 8 or 10 hours a day. And it's dusty, it's hot, the you know, your skin gets irritated and you're picking, it's boring. And then they were getting minimum wage, and I was thinking, like, how would you actually budget your minimum wage if you're making, what was it, $7 an hour maybe, and you go and you have to buy lunch that's $5, the water's bad in the valley, so you have to buy water at, I don't know what it is, a gallon, but I had a whole list of costs and what it would cost to live, and then the rent, which was at that time, because of the housing boom, even the rents were going up, so people were packed together. I mean, the housing was unbelievably overcrowded, substandard,
and they can't afford
horrific.
The food they pick.
Yeah, they don't eat the food they pick.
Tragic
irony. Amazing. And
I went into a grocery store and they had apples from Washington, oranges from Florida, you know, and then they had the rest was like packaged processed food.
So what are people eating who pick the food that we eat here on the coasts?
They're eating cheap, fast calories. They're eating what they're trying to use their few dollars to buy as many calories per dollar. And that usually is fast food and processed food. They're not buying organic vegetables.
And what are the conditions people are living in?
They're bad.
They're bad.
I mean, the housing is substandard. You have numerous families
living. Looking at some of your pictures of these trailers.
Yeah, there's trailers. I mean, that particular trailer camp up in Mendota, for example, and Mendota is a city which is largely undocumented workers from Mexico and El Salvador. And there's trailer camps. They're living in trailers. They're paying a huge amount of money. In fact, we went to one of the trailers in which the dad, I think there
Sal.
Were... four or five people living in this tiny trailer, and he came out with his paycheck to show Melanie his paycheck because he kept telling us how much he made, and we just looked at him wondering, how can you possibly survive?
He had a family of five kids or something, and he made $350 for picking melons for 2 weeks, and he had to pay $300 a month for his, or something. I'm not sure
what he said
exact.
In the book, $300 a month, yeah.
Something, yeah, for his trailer. And it wasn't even like a full-size trailer. It was a camper trailer. You know, like the size of a bathroom. I mean, and they, you know, so it's just astonishing. And they had no, you know, they had to go out for their running water. It's just very, very primitive. And it's just not right in this country.
And then, in fact, we went to, as a downturn hit, we discovered that there were all these food lines happening because people were being thrown out of work. There was a big fight going on around the water issues, particularly in the Westland Water District. And the farmers, as part of their tactics, were not planting and were then pressing the government and the state government, the federal government. You know, these workers have no work. And the slogan was no water, no work. And then all of a sudden popped up food lines in which these workers who had been picking food now all of a sudden are in line waiting. I mean, it was unbelievable. Waiting for maybe 2 or 3 hours to get a bag of food. And
from like a food bank?
From a community. It was a community center that, and they get it from, I think, Catholic Charities, and they distributed food throughout the valley. And I remember Melanie deconstructing the bag of food, and it was just, how can you wait in line for 3 hours for what they're giving you, which was not that healthy?
You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and my guests are Ken Light and Melanie Light. They have this new documentary, photojournalism, Valley of Shadows and Dreams. It was at the Oakland Museum of California, and they're going to be in Fresno at Arte Americas on this Sunday afternoon. February 24th is the opening of that exhibit from this book, which again is Valley of Shadows and Dreams. And we'll have link to all of this, including their website, at yourcallradio.org. You mentioned that the divide between, say, we in the coastal and the valley is maybe more pronounced than, say, the divide between north and south in the United States. The other thing that you talk about in the book is the divide in the Central Valley along race and class lines. Can you talk about that a little bit? And then I'd like to get into the politics of both water and power.
Sure. Race and class in the valley. This is very interesting to me. One of the things I discovered is that we have kind of this idea or myth about the Okies and Arkies coming over during the Depression and working the land, and we've sort of mythologized them with like the migrant mother and stuff. But what I discovered is like all those
Dorothea
people,
Lange's,
the Dorothea Lange uh-huh. migrant mother image, which is imprinted deeply in the American psyche. But what I realized is like all those people are citizens, and they had rights, and they had some education, and they had the ability to get ahead. And in fact, a lot of those people did get ahead, and a lot of those people now are owners and run the valley. Huh. And they are constantly talking about their Okie heritage as a justification for doing whatever they want. But meanwhile,
meaning what? Exploiting
like, yeah, they, you know, they kind of talk about being stewards of the land, which is code word for I can do what I want because I own it. But meanwhile, all the brown people and undocumented people who didn't have access to education or rights or, social services or whatever, or, I mean, they do, but limited, have remained more oppressed. And really, it was almost like an apartheid. When we really looked at it, it was shocking to me.
How did you see that manifest? You tell the story of covering these May Day demonstrations in 2006 and then speaking to a white waitress about it, and her reaction was what?
Well, this was in Fresno during the May Day immigration marches, and we were in this restaurant, Fagan's, which I think is a sort of a watering hole for city workers and lawyers. And we just sort of asked around, like, well, what do you think of this? And she literally just, like, looked at us. She hardly even knew it was happening, and she just rolled her eyes and just passed it off as, oh, them kind of thing. And that was shocking to me because this is a big deal. This is the largest demonstration in history in Fresno, and yet it's a non-issue for the white people. They're so disconnected and so separated from this issue of race, and also oddly enough, Fresno is completely disconnected from its own agricultural activities.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, it's like, for her, this whole idea of growing food happens way out there. So even she, even though she's like literally 10 minutes away from the field, has no idea what's really going on. She doesn't know that what the lives are like for these undocumented workers, and she doesn't care. If that kind of answers your question.
Yeah, you write, and I think that in the intro to your book, Thomas Steinbeck also writes about this being kind of an enduring aspect of the Spanish colonial legacy, and that you still see those exact same feudal dynamics playing out today.
Yeah, and that's really true, and it was really interesting. We had, when the book first came out, we had a book signing in Arte Americas, which is a center of Latino and Hispanic art and culture, which is right downtown Fresno, in an amazing, beautiful venue, which kind of blew me away, I think, in terms of supporting the arts. And we had a friend, Hugo Morales, who was the founder of Radio Bilingüe, who's a good friend of mine, and I've known him for decades. And we asked if he would come and kind of moderate a discussion with myself and Melanie about the issues in the valley in the book. And he had unbeknownst to us, his wife had bought him a copy of the book for Christmas. And so we got together, and with the idea it was going to be a dialogue. And he spent an hour, we just sat there, just going on about how the powers in Fresno, the white powers in Fresno, don't even see Hispanic and Latinos. They're just completely invisible. Hmm. They have no power. They're not involved in any of the conversations that happened.
It's like the Deep South was.
It was like the Deep South.
Like
and that was
South.
Just for us. We just, I mean, we kind of saw it. But to hear it being spoken from a native, an individual who lives in this community and who has the heritage of coming from Mexico into California, his dad was a bracero, it was shocking. It was really shocking. And then, in fact, the Fresno Bee, kind of attacked the book. After the New York Times ran a piece of in the Sunday Review about the work with some of Melanie's writing and the photographs, and they hadn't even seen the book, but yet they were so frightened by the idea that outsiders, mm-hmm. As they called us, poverty tourists, would come into their world and dare comment.
And do you think any of that criticism is fair?
No, I don't. I don't. I don't because they're unwilling to look. They're unwilling to see what's right in front of them. They're unwilling to challenge the powers that be or ask questions. They just let those powerful people in the valley do what they want to do. And I mean, things that we saw in some of the photographs and a lot of what Melanie writes about, for example, during the drought, they're building waterfront homes in the Central Valley. It's nutty. I mean, it's something that, I mean, who's thinking? I mean, why would you dig a giant, giant pond and then plan to build houses around it in a place where there's not enough water, where there's a drought, where people are concerned about this, and somehow someone thinks this is a bright idea?
Well, the answer, of course, is that someone's making money off that water because of the way we've sort of skewed the whole water rights thing.
But let's talk about that. Why don't you explain a little bit
of the
water politics in the Central Valley? And one of the things that you talked about was that there are places in the valley that are crumbling because the water has been
sucked out of the ground.
Yeah, that's right. Well, okay, the water in California is so complicated that honestly, even the experts can't really explain it. So I'll do my best to try to talk about this, but please bear with me and have some compassion. So what Holly's referring to is that in California, there's two ways that you get water, basically. One is the snowpack from the Sierras, which is nice and frozen all winter until we need it, and then it flows down nicely for us. And the other place we get it is that the valley itself is a big clay pan, and underneath that is, I think, one of the world's biggest aquifers. I mean, just so much water underneath there that for millennia it's been collecting. And then starting around, I don't know, when they started putting the big pumps in maybe the 30s or 40s, they started pumping water out, which was unregulated. Now, the water that comes from the aquifer is unregulated. The water that comes from the mountains is regulated. So right there you have a big source of confusion and so on and so forth. So they pumped so much water out of the aquifer that the Earth has sunk 2 feet, and it has actually shifted the gravity of the Earth. NASA has kind of recorded that. So that's pretty powerful. That's a lot of water.
And Tulare Lake, which was the largest freshwater lake. I mean, it was bigger.
Outside of the Great Lakes.
Right. It was bigger than Lake Tahoe, is now
gone.
Not a lake. It's gone. It's disappeared. They've pumped the water right out of it.
Well, and there were all these protests about the drought and about Congress creating the drought. Can you explain what that was?
Yes, that was a
And
mass...
I'll give out our number and invite our listeners in just a moment. We've got so much to talk about here with Ken and Melanie that I will invite the rest of you in just a moment. Go ahead.
I'm sure your listeners will really want to respond to all this stuff about water. But that whole thing was, we discovered, was a giant public relations spin, which is part of the reason I think that the coastal Californians are somewhat out of touch, that the growers and the water districts and the growers in partnership are really smart. And they have been, I was shocked at how organized and powerful their PR machine is. They have created this whole story that Congress has created the Dust Bowl because they want Congress and the federal government and state government to release water to them.
And free water.
Free water.
More free water.
More free water.
More free water. So, I mean, that's it in a nutshell. I mean, it's...
I mean, we went to a water march, which was at
started in
Mendota.
Some of the photos are in this book.
In the book. And we went to the water march, and the first thing we saw were, you know, all these, I mean, hundreds, thousands of undocumented workers coming from the ranches. We saw people, foremans with clipboards, checking people's names off. So they were given the day off. So it was kind of like all the agriculture was closed down. The workers were bussed in or told to come to the water march. They were signed in so they could get paid. And then they were given signs, which were made by the landowners. And in fact, at one point, I don't speak Spanish. Melanie does. I said to Melanie, we should find out if these people even understand the signs. So she went up to a group of women farm workers, and in Spanish she said, asked them, can you tell me what the signs say? And they said, no, we don't speak English. But yet they were holding the signs. I felt like I was in communist Russia. I mean, I felt like, you know, this propaganda was being put out there, and everyone was being duped and pulled in to think that these were the workers, and the whole slogan, no water, no work, which everyone you talk to about this, the farm workers, that was the slogan. They knew that slogan. They were told this is the slogan. And there was planes flying overhead with the banner being pulled, and they marched and they marched. And it was a lot of publicity. It was supported by very big by conservative radio, Sean Hannity and others. But yet somehow us people on the coast think it's something completely different. We don't see behind it.
Right. The reporting is not excellent on that, I think. I think there can be some room there. Someone can really dig in much better.
And we're talking with Ken and Melanie Light. They are the photojournalists who have documented the Valley of Shadows and Dreams. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. And I'm going to give out the number. It's 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. If you're from the Central Valley or live or work there, what do you want others to know about life there? And if you have a job in food or farming, how do conditions in the Central Valley affect you? Melanie Light says, it's just not right. So what do we do about that? Give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And I just got an email saying, I'm glad you're having this program. I feel that we as Americans really disconnect from the cheap prices we experience at Costco, Walmart, or wherever, and the reason the food, clothes, and appliances are so low. We ignore the real facts of people who live in poverty to get us these low prices. And we'll continue to talk about that right after this short break. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also send email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. Thank you.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, we'll discuss the state of local journalism. After years of cutbacks, have newspapers finally found their rhythm? How does the online media fit into the scene? And with so many hyper-local outfits starting up over the past few years, are people getting the news that they need and want? Friday is our weekly media roundtable. We'll speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. Today, we're talking about life in the Central Valley and what it reveals about the problems in our industrial food system. We're speaking with Ken and Melanie Light. They spent 5 years documenting the Central Valley through photographs and essays, and their book and exhibit is called Valley of Shadows and Dreams. And they are going to be rolling that exhibit out in Fresno this Sunday afternoon at Arte Americas in Fresno. So you can join that. We'll have links to all of that information at our website, which is yourcallradio.org. And you can join our conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. If you live in the Valley, we'd love to know what you think about the changes that have taken place in the last 5 years or so. And if you're a farmer, what's your perspective on the politics of the Valley? Do you agree with our guests that California agriculture is based on exploitation of the workers and the land? 866-798-8255. As a consumer, how do you think about the conditions of the workers who pick our food? And how can we begin to reassess our relationship with cheap food and deplorable labor conditions? Do you even think about that as a consumer? 866-798-TALK is the number. It's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you guys are opening in Fresno. You talked a little bit about some of the reaction that you've already had. When The Grapes of Wrath was published in 1939, John Steinbeck wrote about, the exploitation of workers in the Central Valley. And that book was, as you say, banned, burned, and debated from coast to coast. So do you have, what are you expecting? What have you heard from people in the Valley so far about your book?
Well, the people in the community really support us, which is really wonderful. The powers that be have kind of been pretty quiet, other than the Fresno Bee kind of ignoring us, or at least ignoring us in terms of the show, and attacking us early on in their art critic. And that was kind of exciting, and a lot of people came to our defense, saying, this is true, you really need to look at this and see this. And I think, and part of, for both of us, doing this work is really, as journalists, as a writer and a photographer, is having a voice and bringing these issues alive and having a debate and not just ignoring these problems.
Yeah, and I would add that really, honestly, in terms of the growers, we're like a gnat on a water buffalo's back. It doesn't matter. They have their machinery in place in Washington, and we're not really a part of that. But what we're hoping is that we are reaching out to everyone else. This is not for the growers. This is not for the industrial agricultural people. They have their shtick. They know exactly what they want to do, and they're doing it. This is to bring awareness and dialogue to the rest of us, and because that's really, if there's change, where it's going to come from.
Ruby in Mill Valley couldn't stay on the line, but she had a question about whether or not you had sent this book to the representatives from the Central Valley, both at the state and national level.
We have not. It's actually
a
good
idea.
But we assume that the media that's been out there, I mean, the New York Times did this big piece, and you have to assume that these congressmen are having people clip stories that relate to their constituency and their community. And so we've been trying to do that through the media and so forth.
And let's go now to Paul with the Pesticide Action Network. It's Paul Towers, who's Director of Organizing and Media at the Pesticide Action Network of North America. And you work to replace hazardous pesticides with ecologically sound and socially just alternatives. So can you talk to us about the pesticides and the health effects on farm workers, Paul? Are you there?
Certainly, yes. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Certainly. The issues of pesticide use in the Central Valley are pronounced and severe. As you know, over 86 million pounds of pesticides are used in just the San Joaquin, the eight San Joaquin counties
Every year?
Each year. And so that's, you know, over half of all the pesticides used in the entire state, more than anywhere else in the country on a per county basis. So it's you know, incredibly significant, not just for farm workers, but for everyone living in the valley. As I think we heard in the first part of the program, these pesticides end up in the air, in water, and people face multiple and repeated exposures, both on from in water and air, but even on some of the produce and food they end up eating. So it's the issue is incredibly significant, and folks living on the in the Central Valley are really on the front lines of exposure. And
what are the health effects of having that kind of exposure on such a regular basis?
Yeah, you know, the science, unfortunately, our current regulatory system does a poor job of assessing what it means to be exposed to pesticides, among other things. Just right now, the Office of Environmental Health Hazard and Assessment at the state level is looking at how you assess what it means to be exposed to multiple and different pesticide exposures, as well as other chemicals that are part of the long, legacy of being the dumping ground of the rest of the state and country in the Central Valley.
And it literally is with the toxic dump in Kettleman City, right?
That's right. I think Kettleman City is really exemplifies this, the environmental injustice that Ken and Melanie talked about in the rest of the valley. And, very much this idea, a toxic waste dump, additional waste and ending up there, particularly from the L.A. area. There, are pesticides used on nearby fields, other industrial operations. Kettleman City, all of these exposures, and it's very, very difficult to parse out, what is the single cause of, the increased number of birth defects in that area. But that's, just one example, and I think is shows what's happening in much of the rest of the valley, which is, increased rates of asthma, increased rates of learning disabilities, ADHD and autism. And these are linked to many of the, environmental health exposures that folks living in the Central Valley face.
Go ahead, Ken.
I was going to say, you have to realize being out in the fields like Melanie and I were that, they're having airplanes fly over, and these airplanes just spray. It's not actually that accurate, and you get overspray. You might be driving down the freeway, and the spray goes over your car. And I saw people using helicopters, and the guys who were mixing the chemicals were absolutely no masks, no gloves, no protective clothing. And, they're young kids hired. They probably have no idea even what chemicals they're using or that they might be dangerous. No posting of signs. So there is regulation, but somehow it doesn't seem to be regulated. And that number of the amount of pesticides is kind of frightening.
Yeah. What did you say? 86 million pounds?
That's right. Over 86 million pounds in just those eight counties in the San Joaquin Valley.
Jerry Brown vetoed a bill that would have required shade and water for all farm workers last year, right? What was this bill? I've got in 2011, Jerry Brown vetoed a bill that would have supported farm workers' rights, giving them access to shade and water, and would have made it a crime for farmers not to provide adequate shade and water to their field workers. It was Assembly Bill 2676, and he vetoed it. Did you want to speak to that, Paul?
Well, certainly. I think that the challenges and problems facing farm workers are many, varied, and the conditions are incredibly severe under which many of these farm workers work in the Central Valley. The heat, the peak of the summer, over 100 degree heat working in the fields, it's incredibly difficult. The lack of available fresh, high quality drinking water in many places is difficult. These are the challenges that workers face, exposure from pesticides. So there are many of them. And unfortunately, there aren't enough protections in place.
And a lot of the time, these are workers who don't have any idea that they have any rights and are living in fear of deportation or what you guys talk about, blacklisting.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, they're in the shadows. They're completely hidden.
Yeah, they've done studies where they have polled undocumented workers, and they don't even, half of them don't even know if they're part-time or full-time. They don't know if they're eligible for unemployment. They don't know if they can go to the hospital. They don't know, and they're afraid to ask. They're afraid to ask because any contact could be the last contact they have, and they'll be shipped back at any moment.
Let's go to Isaiah in Patterson, who's lived in the Central Valley his whole life. Hi, Isaiah. Thanks for joining our conversation.
Hello. How are you doing?
Good.
You know, I mean, you guys are talking about right now as far as the water and shade and stuff. And, I mean, when I go visit my mother and she lives in Dos Palos, I mean, you have to drive. I live in Patterson, so I take I-5, and I'm a seeing, I love watching landscape and whatnot, and at the same time, I'm also observing other changes in pretty much the geographical changes, what's going here, or they're planting this here. And one thing is I do see a lot of shade wagons. There are these trailers that have shades, and they have water, and they have the restrooms. It's all like one little unit, and I'm going to be honest with you. I see a lot of it. I also travel, of course, out down into Salinas because I have family down there too, and they got a lot of those out there. So I think a lot of employers that they do see that this climate. I mean, of working out there in this kind of a climate, it is pretty harsh. It is, and I worked it myself coming right out of high school, and I know it's pretty harsh. But you know, there are some very, very fair employers out there, and yeah, there are some that are kind of shady. But you make do with what it is.
Isaiah, can you stay on with us for just a moment? I'd like to get a response from Ken and Melanie. Can you just respond to Isaiah, who's saying that maybe there's a much more nuanced picture than the portrait that you're painting for us? And stay on the line, Isaiah. I'm going to get back to you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there are good employers. But I can tell you the portable toilets have been around for quite some time, for generations. You know, they came about the same time that California banned the short hoe, which I remember in the early 70s. Everyone thought the short hoe was good until finally California banned it. It was a short hoe where people had to bend over to weed the plants. And I would say from my actually going out into the fields, not just driving by them and talking to people and seeing what goes on, I mean, most of these people are working piece rate. They're not, some of them are being paid by the hour, but a lot are being paid by piece rate. So if you're picking tomatoes, for example, you're getting paid by the bucket. You're not getting paid a minimum wage. And I would have to personally kind of disagree.
All right, let's go back to Isaiah. Go ahead, Isaiah. I think you had another question, and if you wanted to respond to Ken.
Well, I wanted to respond to what he was saying. And, yeah, I mean, I have no relatives that do that piecework, that work the tomato fields and buckets and whatnot. And, I mean, if we really – I don't want to go against what you're saying because I see that it's wrong, too, because they work long hours. And most of the people that are working out there are immigrants. They are here illegally. But who else is going to do this job? And I'm not trying to say that, oh, my gosh, just because they're illegal, they have to endure this kind of punishment and whatnot. But it's the most economical way. Otherwise, we're going to be eating Roma tomatoes that are costing $5.99 a pound. But here's the thing. These people come willingly. They come and do this job that nobody wants to. I mean, we see the unemployment rate in California sky high. And in the summertime, there is an abundant amount of agricultural work, but no one wants to do it because of the severity of the climate. And, oh, maybe even the whole, how can I say it, when they label you, oh, it's like, oh, my gosh, you're working out in the fields. You know, everybody wants a Starbucks job for about $25 an hour, but that's not going to happen for everybody.
Starbucks pays $25 an hour?
Really, sign me up.
You know, we all want jobs in the office and whatnot, and, but you know what? There's plenty of jobs out there. And you know what? If people here would actually get off their butts, I'm going to be honest with you, I think with as good as education that we do receive, you know, being out there working, I mean, I think people themselves would be able to fix this problem, you know?
All right, good. That's a good place for us to throw that to Melanie. She wanted to respond. Thank you for calling, Isaiah.
We love Patterson, by the way.
Yeah, we love Patterson. And how about that Amazon thing that's going into Patterson? That's huge.
I don't know what you're referring to.
This is Amazon is putting a giant
distribution
warehouse
center.
Distribution center there, which is supposed to be increasing, I mean, getting bringing in a lot of jobs. But anyway, Isaiah, yeah, it just sounds like you're frustrated. It sounds like you feel like, in a way, there's no other way to deal with this situation. And also, it sounds like you're at the end there, you're kind of talking about people and education and jobs. And what we're talking about are people who don't have education, who don't have rights, who don't even have citizenship working on our behalf to grow our food, right? And it sounds like you've had some experience out there in the field, and you know what this is like. So I'm just saying, you know, there's a guy over at UC Davis. I can't remember his name right now, but he's an agricultural economist. And so he did a huge study. And what he found is that if we raised the minimum wage of field workers to $14 an hour, that would only, in your pocket and my pocketbook at the end of the month, it would only cost like less than $15 a month for all of those people to have an actual living wage. I mean, that's not that much, really, Isaiah. And also, here's what I mean. It's like, these are people who are desperate. These are people who no one else in America wants to do that work. And they probably wouldn't want to do it if they didn't have to either. But really, couldn't we be a little bit more compassionate?
And let's go to more of our callers. I'm going to give out the number one final time if you want to join our conversation, wondering what you as a consumer think about the conditions of the laborers who pick and harvest our food here in California. The number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's go to Jerry in Oakland. Hi, Jerry.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for joining us.
You bet. In my younger days, I was active in a movement called the United Farm Workers. Cesar Chavez,
yes,
the leader of this. He's iconic. He's a saint. What happened to the UFW? I thought we fixed everything. And hearing that Jerry Brown vetoed a bill to benefit farm workers, Jerry Brown was elected because, in many ways, he supported UFW. He was the guy who banned the short-handled hoe, which was causing incredible orthopedic problems for people. What happened? Where did all that go?
So it sounds like you're shocked to hear that the conditions are as bad or worse than they probably were in the 60s and 70s.
Yes.
Stay on the line with us. Let me have Ken and Melanie respond.
Well, what we found with the UFW is that it's been really eviscerated and emasculated, I guess, really, in a way. It's really kind of a social services outfit. Now, for instance, when we were at the Water March, there is some people handing out flyers for the United Farm Workers. And they were like basically kicked out. And I think what we found is that the farm workers are so, I hate to use that word, oppressed, that they live in such fear that they're afraid to be empowered and to use the United Farm Workers as a vehicle to move forward.
Go ahead, Jerry.
They're doomed. The farm workers are doomed if they're afraid. Imagine if Walter Reuther had been afraid in 1937 to lead those farm workers over the Rogue River and establish the UAW as a bargaining.
But remember,
people died in that. You know, they were
that's
shot
right.
by American troops.
But remember, those auto workers weren't going to be sent back to the old country. They weren't going to be picked up and put in a van and photographed and fingerprinted and put on a boat and sent back to Poland or
separated from their family
or wherever they went.
UFW people were sent to the morgue.
Yeah, of course, of course.
That's what you have to do. It's not going to come easy. Power doesn't cede, just hand things over to people because it's hard on them.
But Jerry, what do you think, what responsibility do we as the consumers who are so divorced from this process of
yeah,
how our food is, what should we do?
We should be doing the things that we're doing, the organic food movement, whatever we can do. We can also vote. I was going to say we can vote for politicians that will support us, but Brown, I can't believe that story about him vetoing that bill. That's just so out of character what I thought he represented. I'm going to contact him today, believe me.
Well, thank you so much for
calling. Maybe you can get a copy of the book and send it to him.
You
guys should be sending this to some of the politicians.
Absolutely.
We should.
So, Bill, let's go to another caller. Bill in Santa Cruz, welcome to your call. Thanks for joining our conversation.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Fine, thanks.
Hey, I was wondering, you know, this is a labor issue about exploitation of labor, and I was wondering what you would think about making e-verify mandatory on employers and then heavily penalizing employers that employ undocumented workers?
Well, it's supposed to be happening, and it's not. It's kind of the little valley secret that all these employees who work out in the fields are supposed to be verified, but they get around it. They have labor contractors. The labor contractors get paid, and then you can often see in the valley at the end of the day, the labor contractors have broken down vans. They pull into a gas station. They have 8 or 9 people in it, and they dole out the cash. And so there seems to be in America kind of, you know, an ethic in which we can get around things. We have maybe rules, but they don't actually work for everyone. And there's, you know,
cronyism in the valley is so strong and so alive that, you know, it's very hard to change practices. And sometimes, honestly, even if you want to be the good guy, you know, the pressure all around you to maintain the status quo is also very, very strong.
Well, that's one of the things that you write about that I'd like to delve a little deeper into. You write that this is not just about sort of labor justice and an ecological justice, but this is about the fundamentals of our democracy being eroded. Explain.
Well, I mean, ultimately, when we kind of started looking at this, I kept trying to trace it, you know, to the source. And, of course, all roads lead to Rome. And what I really found is that historically in California and also nationally, I mean, the way this country was built is by special interest group lobbying the government for subsidies as we developed through all our different phases of, you know, the railroads and whatever, urbanization and so on and so forth. And so these are the tradition in America is for the special interest groups to get their needs met first. And in California, that's been true from the get-go. So the power system is deeply entrenched. Really.
We're running out of time here. So the book is called Valley of Shadows and Dreams. It's by Ken and Melanie Light. They'll be opening an exhibit in Fresno this Sunday at the Arte Americas gallery, and that's Sunday afternoon in Fresno this February 24th at Arte Americas. They'll be opening their new exhibit of these photos. Can you both maybe just choose one of your babies from this book and give us a little bit of a visual sense of what's in here?
Sure. Since we were talking about pesticides, I was going to talk about one of the pictures, Emmanuel and his mother. And this was a photograph taken in Kettleman City, which I heard about. There was a lot of talk about the problems and a huge number of young children being born with a cleft palate. And it was kind of being ignored by the Department of Health. It was being ignored by the state. And it was actually environmental organizations outside the valley and inside the valley that kind of began to represent these people and give them a voice. And no one's really clear about what's happening around that. But that was a moment, going into that house and meeting that woman and her holding her little son who had cleft palate. It was just an incredibly touching moment.
Yeah, it's a beautiful photo. Let's bring Paul Towers back on from Pesticide Action Network. Can you maybe give us a note of hope here? Can you tell us something that you're working on to help deal with the vast amount of pesticides that are going into this area?
Certainly. Well, I think that, you know, one, we talked a little bit about the challenges around undocumented workers feeling unsafe or unable to report some of the challenges that they face in the fields or on the front lines. And so we've created some tools, actually with the help of the Environmental Protection Agency, in individual counties we're currently piloting, called Keene and Fern in Fresno and Kern counties respectively, that allow people to anonymously text, email, call, any sort of challenges or problems they face. So,
wow, that's fascinating. Thank you so much for that, Paul. We're just running out of time, so I want to get some final thoughts from Melanie and Ken. You write in the book, it seems that people just need to know more about what's happening so they can find their own voice about this, and that seems to be your hope. So what are you urging people to do that have now gotten a little more clarity about what's happening?
I think they have to start asking questions about their food. I think they have to, question, does the food have pesticides? Who's picking the food? I think we need to look deeper at the water issues. And I think one of the things Melanie has said, when we drive from the Bay Area to Los Angeles, down I-5. We need to get off of I-5.
And check out a little town. Go into a little taqueria, walk around, talk to people. You know, don't be afraid. Connect. And this is the beginning. I mean, Mark Bittman talks about the food movement. We think like, oh, organic food, oh, blah, blah, blah. It's been going for 40 years. But really, organic food is 1% of the market. This is the beginning. This is our opportunity to shape and integrate our lifestyle and our food in a beautiful, sustainable way.
One of the things we do every summer is we drive into the valley and we buy fruit. And so, you know, you can go to the Berkeley Bowl and get peaches for $2.25 a pound. You can go into the valley and for $7 you can buy a lug, 35 pounds, and you can see what it's all about. And get a copy of our book. There's only a few copies left, Valleys of Shadows and Dreams.
And we'll put a link to that at yourcallradio.org. Ken and Melanie Light are the co-creators of the book, Valley of Shadows and Dreams. They'll be opening an exhibit in Fresno this Sunday at Arte Americas. Ken Light is a professor of journalism at the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. Melanie Light is a photography writer and founding executive director of PhotoVision. And Paul Towers also joined us by phone. Thank you, Paul. He's with Pesticide Action Network. And we'll put a link to all of that information at yourcallradio.org. And thanks to everybody who called. I'm sorry we couldn't get to everybody. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. What's the state of local journalism today? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about how local media outlets are doing. After years of cutbacks, have newspapers finally found their place? How does online media fit into the scene? With so many hyper-local outlets starting up over the past few years, are people getting the news they need and want? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. How can those of us who care about local news and consume it make sure it has a future? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.